Well, hi everybody, how are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you oh so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. What am I doing? I'm hearing an echo. Sounds like something that you would hear, something you would use your ears to pick up on. But as they say famously, in space, no one can hear you scream. But you would be robbed of some truly excellent music. You got some fantastic, world-class, seasoned composers adding to this mythology, legacy, atmosphere. And we have one of the most premier wheelmen in the business. TVs, video games, movies. Hopping on the show with us, we'd like to welcome Jeff Russo. Russo. How are you today? Thank you for being here. How's things in your world?
I'm good. Just, you know, working, writing the music, having a good time, putting out fires. That's what we hope to do.
You still have your hair. You got a roof over your head. You must be doing something right, Jeff.
There is a roof, and I do have a good amount of hair left, which is only like what all we can ask for at this point.
Exactly. Well, it's funny, you know, whenever I cover music or whenever I speak to composers or just keep my ear to the ground as far as a consumer, two names consistently pop up that baffle me. One is Jeff Russo. The other one is Bear McCreary. I don't know how you do it all, and I'd like to know how you get it all done. Can you pull back the curtain? Is there a mystery, mystique? Would we ruin anything letting out trade secrets?
No, I mean, there's no curtain, really. It's just like, you know, I have a very dedicated team of people that I work with, you know, from editors and engineers and mixers and assistants and stuff. Like, in order to get it all done, you know, when you work at a high level of turnaround, you know, you have to be able to just focus on the one thing. For me as a composer, I have to be able to focus on one thing for a certain amount of time, which is writing the music. Because I'm also, so I can't really focus on a lot of the things that also need to be focused on, editing and mixing. And, you know, there's a million things where when you're working on more than one project, it would be impossible to focus on all the little details. So, you know, you have to help with all that stuff. Like, it can't be done by one person. You know, so it's if anything, the curtain reveals, you know, a team of people working in concert in order to get from point A to point B. You know, like, I write a cue, I give it to one person who then gives it to another person who gives it to another person, and then, you know, then we record it. So there's so much in between the time of conceiving a piece of music to it being finished. You know, so there's that. I don't pretend to know how Bear does his thing. I can only assume it's in a similar way. You know, he has assistants and editors and people who work behind the scenes in order to affect his vision from point A to point B, you know. It's interesting that that's the first time, I think, in an interview that anybody has said our two names together. Like, I've met Bear. I know Bear. I wouldn't say I know him all that well, but we've certainly met, and we certainly work in the same, you know, universe. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it, because what you did is you dispelled two things. Is that one, true, one person can't do it all. So you're definitely lauding your team. You're exposing the roster, the bench, the bullpen, whatever sports analogy you want to use. But the beautiful thing also is you have trust. So how long does it take to develop the trust to sound engineers, music editors, whoever, you know, STEM coordinator?
It takes a long time. It does. You know, typically people who have worked for me start as an intern and then move up the ranks all the way to, okay, they've now left and gone out on their own, you know, in different capacities, certainly in different ways. You know, I've had one orchestrator. Certainly you need a really good orchestrator who takes your sequences and puts them on paper and makes sure it all can be read and played by musicians, if that indeed is the way that a score is going to be made. I mean, sometimes scores are just me and my sequencer and varying degrees of synthesizers, which you can't see behind me because I have the earth behind me.
Lost in space.
But, you know, there's a whole wall of synthesizers, and, you know, it's scores that I do are made in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's just me and my sequencer. Sometimes it's me and a 90 piece orchestra, you know, and everywhere in between. So I think in order to do, when I'm by myself, I could certainly make a score alone, you know, and what fun is that? There's no fun.
Whenever they talk about film, it's famously said that you make a film three times. You make it when you write it, you make it when you shoot it, you make it and when you edit it. Do similar parallels exist for you as a composer? When you have an idea versus a MIDI versus when the symphony plays it?
Well, yeah, certainly it's different. Like it's one thing when I write it. It's another thing when I start to really conceive of how it's going to sound as I layer things on it. And then when an orchestra, if an orchestra is going to play it or any live musicians are going to play on it, like when that happens, it becomes something else. So there's no one way for me to do it. There's no one, like there's no rule book, there's no playbook, right? It's just take things as it comes. As you know, I've been working on Alien Earth for almost 5 years. Right. Like since Noah wrote the first script, he sent me the first script and I started writing, you know, he's got a new thing that he's developing now. He just sent me a script and I told him, I was like, you know, that as soon as I start reading the script, I'm going to start writing material. And he was like, yeah, I know that. That's why I sent it to you. So, you know.
Well, going back to what you said about how things change over the course of the process, I think what is really, if we're going to just jump to Alien Earth really quick, the Q Wendy is done in, at least in the soundtrack, is presented in two ways, a quintet and then the prime version. And it really lets you pick up on what nuance there is, whether it's just the four-note motif. But then you also have, you know, how it it's layered on with effects and not synthesizers, but like things that make it more otherworldly. So it's nice that you have those two worlds colliding on the same soundtrack for us to experience.
You know, I needed to be able to do that in a lot of different ways. You know, I typically write motifically, you know, thematically, so that I can use melodies in different places with different styles and different instruments. I recorded a quintet version. I recorded a quintet version because I could. And because of that, I ended up using some of that material in varying parts of the score. You know, a lot of times I will record full suites of themes and then try to figure out via editing how things are going to work inside the show. And then once that happens, I typically then orchestrate or re-orchestrate material to be re-recorded to be put in place.
Is that specific to, you know, like your current working condition or project, or is it something you've developed over the years?
I mean, I think it's been the way I've done certain types of projects. I mean, again, there's no playbook. There's no rule book. Like, I don't subscribe to a specific way of doing things, you know?
Well, I can appreciate that. I think that sometimes creatives might get stuck in a rut is a wrong way of saying it, but let's just take John Barry, for instance. If you listen to Out of Africa or The Lion in Winter, you can tell it's a John Barry score. But, you know, when you listen to Altered Carbon or Lucy in the Sky, you're not really sure if that's a Russo product or not. So it really, you know, you are able to work with the flavor of the instruments in your hand or at hand or the project du jour, whatever it is.
You know, that's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, I think, like, there are similarities between those scores. And if you were to listen to my entire catalog from the last 5 years, even 6 years, you'll definitely hear through lines, things that I typically like to do. But I do try to make each project have its own unique identifiable sound, you know, without putting too much of my own sound into it. But, you know, I'm human. There's really only so much of that I can do without it having some of me in it. So I don't know. It's hard to really say, like, how I can go about really delineating between two scores. Like, I write music based on a feeling that I get from the narrative. You know, I don't know, a piano sounds like a piano until you start messing with it. So if I'm writing on piano, it's going to sound like writing on piano. But if you start messing with it a little bit and changing it, you can make it sound like not a piano.
Speaking of, you know, 5 years is quite a long process. You could learn a language in that amount of time. You can, you know, see a president or the Olympics, you know, go, come and go. I guess what is, speaking of through lines, what is a through line that stuck over those 5 years? And how did, like, what was good and what landed?
Well, I mean, nothing didn't land. You know, there wasn't, I don't know that there's anything that I wrote for the show that didn't actually, there might be one. Might be one piece of music that didn't make it into the show, but not a lot. And that was a tonality thing. Like there was a moment where we were thinking about doing something that had a little more whimsy to it. And I had written a piece of music with that in mind. And when it ended up, when we ended up putting it to picture and we ended up watching it, Noah called me and he was like, you know, there's the whimsical idea was probably not the right idea and I might have sent you in the wrong direction. And I was like, yeah, you know, I get it. I said, I got the idea and I understood why he wanted to try it. And that's the thing about, working with, you know, with Noah is like, there are no rules, right? Like try anything. And if it's gonna work, it's gonna work. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. Like no harm, no foul. You know, we've been sort of working that way the entire 15 years we've been working together. And he's always open to ideas from me. I mean, for music, like, you know, I can't speak about any other of the art forms that are involved in the making of these shows or movies. But for me, he was always like open to me trying something. And if it worked, great. And if it didn't, okay, it'll work something somewhere else in some other place, you know.
Well, one of the reasons that I'm curious about this topic is because as I'm in a creative industry myself, I work on hotels and as interior designer and an architect. And I don't know if you remember the guitar-shaped building in Florida, the Hard Rock. It's got the outline of a. So I was on the design team on that, and normally with hotels, you do what's called a mock-up room. So I'm pretty sure like. You know, not to say temp music is the same thing, but like you do a sketch or something like to just to get buy off. So we do a model room and you would imagine that these things take years and need a lot of approval, but you're looking at three different model rooms trying to decide which of these is the right fit for the building. And over time you look at a headboard long enough or a bathroom, you're like, I'm bored of it. You know, it nothing was wrong with it, but just the virtue of time, you just look at it and you go, let's try something else. And sometimes trying something new doesn't make it better. You know, you might have had the right answer all along. Long-winded way of just saying I could kind of appreciate where 5 years exists in your creative process, but it's kind of tough to see it from day to day, you know?
I mean, 5 years, it's not 5 years of looking at it and changing it. You know, there's 8 hours of a show that required many, many, many hours of music that needed to be written. So I try never to go backwards. I'm always trying to keep moving forward with writing and continuing to be creative with a project, right? So everything that I do needs to push me farther and farther in the direction that I want to go. So I'm not really looking backwards. I'm really always looking forward. So with the 5 years of writing, it's like, okay, so I got to write of this first piece of music 5 years ago. And then, you know, there was maybe a little bit of time, a few months before I started writing the next piece of music. And then like, we took a break, we made an entire series, Fargo season 5. And that was I got to stop with Alien and start on that. You know, so I got to really live with it. And with every time you live with something, the next step is always, I think, a little more deliberate. Every step is deliberate. And if every step is deliberate, then you're always walking in the right direction, always moving in the right direction. And that, to me, was one of the things that sort of gave us the opportunity to make something as, I think, connected as it is. And it's, you know, it's emotionally connected. It's like connected to the original underlying storylines and feeling. And I'm connected musically and emotionally connected to the characters. And that was sort of the whole thing. And these characters developed over 5 years. You know, Wendy's character developed over 5 years. Morrow's character, I mean, Morrow's character was different in the first script that I read. Morrow's character was a different character. And to me, as it develops, as the characters develop, as the story develops, so does the music.
I get you. And I kind of figured it wasn't 5 years every day, but thank you for clarifying it. But, you know, when you talk about, like, tying it to a universe, it feels like there's a couple cues that have just the most minute echoes to maybe what Horner did or what Goldsmith did. And you're leaning into things like Earth Part 2 or Gear Up. It has a little bit of freneticism. But then you do some really wild and inventive stuff like Procession. Can you break down what's happening with Procession? It's like guitars gone wild, man.
I mean, I wouldn't say it was guitars gone wild. It's just two guitars playing, like,
but
one
perception is reality. Like, what's coming through my ears? I'm like, holy cow, I can't do that.
So there's a guitar playing a rhythm part, like some chords, and then there's me playing, you know, a guitar solo over it with some synthesized, some other sounds involved. And, you know, again, that particular piece of music is an outlier in, you know, 7.5 hours of music written for this show. That particular piece of music is the only one of its kind, right? It's the only one that is me playing guitar. That's it. Like, there's no other piece of music like that. And, you know, it was one of those things where we just wanted to see something and feel something different in that particular moment of the show, where you might not have ever heard anything like that in an alien property. You know, yes, I did Easter egg tip my hat to Horner's score. I did do a tip of my hat to Jerry Goldsmith's score. You know, like, so when you're reimagining what an underlying property is, right? The idea is not to copy it, right? The idea is to figure out what it is that made the audience feel, and then try to make the audience feel that same thing, that same feeling in a unique way. So I understood what Goldsmith's score was doing. I understood what Horner's score was doing. And I wanted to be able to merge those two things and then add a completely different flavor to it, all while trying to keep the audience inside of that feeling that they had watching that first movie and watching that second movie, which, by the way, there were different feelings for that first movie and that second movie. That first movie is a great horror, is like one of the greatest horror movies ever made. And that second movie is one of the greatest action movies ever made. So there's this great militaristic action music that Horner did that, you know, so yeah, I did a little militaristic snare stuff because I wanted to tip my hat to that. There's the, you know, there's the echoplex on the horn motif. Bapo, 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 bapo. That's a tip of the hat because that was something I could do that would literally take the listener, you know, from point A to point B instantly. If you've seen those movies, right? Like if you've experienced that. And if not, then that would be something new for you, right? So yeah. There is a little bit of that, and then there's the new that, you know, I use these voices, and I put voices in some of the pieces because it was a way for me to humanize the score. I'm sort of in the middle of humans, hybrids, aliens, right? So there's human, then there's almost human, then there's non-human. And I don't know, you're watching this show, it's like, it feels like the humans are the bad guys, right? Like, it doesn't even feel like the aliens are the bad guys. Like, all of a sudden you have empathy for the aliens. You don't have that in the first movie. You do have that a little bit in the second movie, especially when Sigourney Weaver's character says to Paul Reiser's character, you know, I don't know. You don't see the aliens fucking over the other aliens for a piece of, you know, for a share or whatever it was she's saying. You know, she said, I don't know it exactly, but you know the line. And as does every single person who saw that movie. And it's like at that moment you realize, like, oh, it's the humans that are the bad guys, not the aliens. So I had to figure out a way to sort of cross that divide, you know, like the human aspect. And there's, you know, Hermit, who's, you know, he's one of the good guys, obviously. And there's the way Hermit and Wendy sort of have a connection. And how do I do that in a human way and then also in a non-human way? So to me, voices sort of helped with that. The sort of crossing the idea of human, non-human, you know.
Well, I could say, just watching the smile that came to your face talking about the mythology and mindset that went in, it seems like you had so much fun. I really like the Weyland-Yutani theme, as simple as it is. It really kind of seeps you into the world, says, hey, this is ground zero, let's go to work. But like, what other elements did you find, if not inspiring, just, you know, liberating and makes you smile now that it's all put together?
Well, you know, it's like the idea of building this world. World building is really something that I enjoy, right? Like building a sound world, building a world of music to accompany a story is the thing that I enjoy the most. Maybe it's tied. It's probably tied with conducting the orchestra. Because to me, you know, like I can write, and then it's the moment that I stand in front of the orchestra and the orchestra starts to play that something happens that I could never have expected. I don't know what is going to happen. I have an idea. You know, I see the notes on paper. I see the notes on the screen that I'm putting. And, you know, but how a human being is going to interpret that and then turn those thoughts into movements, you know, there's really no way you can ever know. And that's one of the greatest things. So the world building part and then the unknown part of the performance of the score, those are the two, you know, most enjoyable things for me when making scores like this, you know. And I've done it with Noah on a number of occasions. Like with Legion, the world building in Legion was incredibly fun because I got to make this sort of, you know, orchestral psychedelic rock kind of stuff, which was a lot of fun to me. And Fargo, building a new world every year with Fargo is really incredible because I get to, you know, write new thematic material every year, with a few exceptions, obviously the main theme, and then there's the bad guy theme. But I imagine that same thing will happen with Alien, except I'm going to have to figure out how to connect seasons one and two, if there is a season two. I'm assuming I'll have to figure out how to connect those two seasons, you know, from an emotional standpoint. But
well, like you said, you look forward, you don't look back. But I would assume that when you do look at season two, that would be the opportunity to say, okay, what makes sense to carry through? And again, it's still dictated by picture or, you know, notes and words from Noah and whoever's crafting the show. But it's, I mean, it, talk about an embarrassment of riches. I mean, again, just seeing you come to life talking about it shows you you're doing what you need to. And I think that's, you know, you make it, we buy it, it lives with you for a certain time. But then it's, you know, it's in our heads. It's earworms in an elevator. It's driving, you know, down the highway listening to, you know, the music you do. So it's... to that point, how do you know it's right? How do you get to a point like, yep, this is it, don't touch it anymore?
Well, you know, if it feels right, it must be right. That's really the, I sort of live by that. Like, if it sounds good, it must be good, right? And so I don't know. There isn't a moment where you're like, aha, it's right. You know, you just sort of, writing a score for something like this or for anything, it's like feeling around in the dark. It's like, you know, you're doing it, and you sit back and you watch and you're like, yeah, we did that, you know. It isn't so specific and particular that you could pick out little things that would say, yes, okay, at that moment I knew I was right. You know, you never know until somebody watches it and goes, wow, that's great. And then you're like, oh shit, like I remember sitting there I was sitting next to Dana, who's our one of our directors and executive producers and cinematographers. He's like, you know, very in touch with what the show looks like. And we were at the premiere in London. We were watching the first episode, and it all went by. And I turned to him and I was like, oh my God, we made that. Like it was incredible. It was an incredible experience because, you know, by the way, yes, I'm involved in making the music and putting it all into the show. But as I'm watching it, I'm watching pre-VFX. I don't even at the final mixes, the VFX wasn't done. So I had never seen the final until that moment. And so I got to have an experience that I don't typically have, which is I was like, holy shit, there it is. It's made. I can't believe it happened. You know, with everything put together and all of it finally finished, it's like, and there was a small country's worth of people involved in making the show, right? Yes, there's heads of departments and, you know, but, you know, if you look at the list of people who were involved in the VFX, I mean, that's like 6 pages long in the credits list. You know, there's hundreds upon hundreds of people involved in just that. So anyway,
please, this is your chance to shine. This is your jumping off point to yell. It's kind of like everybody is either peanut butter or jelly, and they're all wondering, like, I think I'm pretty good on my own. And then when you see the sandwich put together, like, holy cow, people love this. This is great. Unless you have a peanut allergy, then it goes out the window. But
thankfully, I do not.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your time. Everyone, check out Alien Earth. The series will come to a finale on the 25th of September. We look forward to it, but we do not look forward to saying goodbye to Jeff because his music is so impacting. Jeff Russo, everyone, thank you for your time, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks for having me.